Automate Your Warehouse with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 10th episode of Robots, on the 10th day of the 10th month of 2008. In this episode, we'll spend some time talking to Raffaello D'Andrea, a professor at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich and founding member of Kiva Systems.
After the talk, we'll be hearing the second quarter of Jack Graham's Selkie story. And now to start out, here's the news from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Japanese company Cyberdyne is the first to mass-produce a robotic exoskeleton. HAL, which stands for Hybrid Assistive Limb, consists of a pair of robotic legs and arms that strap onto a person's limbs and reinforce their movement. At a total weight of 23 kilograms for the full suit, HAL is comparably lightweight. According to Cyberdyne, a full battery charge allows continuous operation for 2 hours and 40 minutes. Unlike some other exoskeletons which rely on detecting motion to activate the suit, HAL relies on nerve impulses detected on the skin surface. This makes the suit suitable for some disabled persons unable to move their limbs without assistance. The suit can also assist people performing jobs that require a great deal of physical strength. For a start, Cyberdyne will produce up to 500 exoskeletons per year. In Japan, the lower part of the robot suit will also be available for rent for $2,000 for both legs and $1,500 for one leg per month starting today. Readers of our forum may remember the Fly Flight simulator demonstrated by Caltech researchers earlier this year. Researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, have now used a similar simulator to have a fly steer a robot. The setup consists of a camera-equipped robot in a small arena with obstacles, an LED display that transforms the camera input into patterns of vertical and horizontal stripes, a fly tethered to a wire, and a monitoring system measuring the fly's movement. As a tethered fly tries to move forward, the monitoring system records its motion and translates it into motor commands for the robot. Images transmitted from the robot camera trigger patterns of stripes on the LED display, allowing the fly to react to obstacles. The result is a fly piloting a robot car as it whizzes through a forest of pillars in the arena. The research aims at constructing a complete computational model of a fly's neural network and may create technology to control future flying robots. Finally, Japan's annual cutting-edge electronics and IT conference, the CEATEC, just exhibited a number of interesting new robots, including a unicycle riding robot by Murata Saiko-chan, a biomimetic robot with bumblebee vision by Nissan, and various humanoids that you might soon meet at a reception desk or in your favorite supermarket's wine section. To learn more about Cyberdyne's exoskeleton, the fly-controlled robot, or the new robots exhibited at CEATEC, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Today's featured guest has been involved in robotics spanning the business, academic, and even the art world. Raffaello D'Andrea is a professor at the Measurement and Control Lab at the ETH in Zurich, Switzerland, but also co-founder of Kiva Systems, an inventory management company out of Massachusetts specializing in multi-robot systems. When not building robots for research or business, D'Andrea tries to bring robotics into arts, teaching a design course whose goal is to build a dynamic structure for public display. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hi, Raf. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Thank you.
Could you please introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Okay. My name is Raffaello D'Andrea. I'm a professor at ETH Zurich. I'm also an engineering fellow of systems architecture at Kiva Systems.
Great. Kiva Systems, let's start with that. So tell us about Kiva Systems. What do you guys do?
Kiva Systems is a, the best way to describe it is a, it's a logistics company who develops systems for distribution. So to make distribution facilities more efficient, and central to its operation are robots. We make systems that employ hundreds of robots that move inventory around in distribution facilities.
That's pretty amazing. I've seen some videos of this on the internet, actually, and it seems like there's hundreds of robots riding around a warehouse. How do you do that? How do you control so many robots at once?
The best way to describe our system is as a hierarchical one. There are, as you mentioned, there's about 500 vehicles in one of our warehouses. They're not controlled from a central computer. It's not that there's a central omnipotent server that sees everything and acts on everything. But there is some sort of centralization because the system is hierarchical. I think the best way to think about it is as it's like an air traffic control system, mm-hmm. where you have, you know, the airplanes make local decisions, but there's still an air traffic controller which directs them to where they should go. And it's very similar to our system in terms of the robots. There are the equivalent of air traffic controllers, which tell the robots where they can go and where they can't go. And in addition, the vehicles themselves have sensors that let them know where they are, if there's other things in the way. But they really rely on the air traffic controller, the equivalent of the air traffic controller, to tell them where it's safe to go.
Okay. Can you maybe give us a visual picture to our listeners of what this system looks like, other than there being hundreds of robots?
Exactly.
What's the point?
Sure. So imagine being in a warehouse, a large open space, and in the center of the warehouse, you have thousands of shelves that are roughly 1 meter by 1 meter by 2.5 meters, say. And these shelves have... basically sitting on what looks like a table, so a 1 meter by 1 meter by, say, 30, 40 centimeter high table.
Mm-hmm.
At the perimeter of this warehouse are people, and the people are sitting in stations, and I'll describe in a minute what it is that they do.
Okay.
Then you have these hundreds of robots that move around the warehouse. They pick up these shelves, and they move them to the perimeter of the warehouse, and the people go to the shelves, and they pick the product from the shelves, and they put it in boxes to fill orders. And the boxes are also brought by other robots. So basically, the right way to think about this is instead of people walking around a warehouse filling orders in a cart, the robots bring all the material to the people at the perimeter of the warehouse. So it solves the problem of people spending the majority of their time walking around. We still use people to do the manipulation, which, as the listeners probably know, is a very difficult problem, especially when you have a variety of products that you have to pick. The robots do the monotonous work of just walking around the aisles.
So how does this compare to other systems? Because I guess up to now, there's warehouses with lots of conveyors and that kind of stuff.
That's right. I mean, you know, let's stick to distribution facilities in particular. There's many forms of automation. There are things like carousels. Think of going to the dry cleaners and picking up your shirts. They type in the number and the carousel moves around until your shirt is there, and then you pick it. Well, there are systems that are like that. For distribution facilities, there are a lot of systems based on conveyors. There's a lot of different technology for automation. Ours is really the first one for distribution facilities, where you have hundreds of robots that move the inventory around instead of having the people move around or having fixed structure automation. And I think that's the key difference, is that our system is it's not fixed structure. The only fixed structure are the navigation markers that you put on the floor, and they're just stickers.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes, we've given demonstrations where we go to an empty warehouse, and in one day we're up and running.
Okay, so it's really a quick setup.
Yep.
I find it interesting that you still have people on the floor. Tell us maybe about the relationship between people and robots. How do people maybe react to having robots whizzing around them?
Right. That's a good point. The way that we think of our system and the way we want our customers to think about our system is not of a system where people coexist with robots. Okay. We think of our system as a machine. And just like you wouldn't put your arm in a moving piece of machinery, we don't expect people to be walking around the middle of the warehouse where the robots are.
Is it dangerous?
It's not dangerous because they have sensors that would tell them if there's a person that is in the way. However, it's an issue of reliability. Mm-hmm. If you were to design a system where robots are expected in operation to coexist with humans, the reliability would need to be, 99.9%. Okay. Our system is not designed to coexist with people. It should still be able to handle somebody running out onto the floor for whatever reason, and it does do that. But it doesn't have to be designed to be 99.9999% being able to spot a person.
Okay, so you really see the robots on one side of the warehouse and the people kind of on the exterior.
Exactly. The way we think about it are people at the perimeter of the warehouse, and the robots in the interior of the warehouse doing all the work of moving the product to the perimeter. It's really no different than fixed structure automation in that sense. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't expect people to sit on a conveyor belt or to be nearby where there's a lot of moving parts.
Definitely, yeah.
So it's exactly the same thing. It just so happens that the things that are moving are mobile robots.
Okay, let's speak about these robots maybe a bit more in detail. Can you describe these orange boxes that are rolling around?
Sure. They are, let's see, in terms of their dimensions, they're roughly, say, 80 centimeters by 50 centimeters by 30 centimeters. They weigh about 150 kilograms. Mm-hmm. They can lift up to 450 kilograms. Mm-hmm. They can move up to 1.2 meters per second.
Okay.
And these are our smaller robots. Then we have a larger version, which are roughly double the size. Although interestingly enough, they're not as tall. They're only about 25 centimeters high, mm-hmm. and they can lift up to 1,400 kilograms. And they themselves weigh, I think, roughly 350 kilograms.
Not bad. That's almost like a small car.
Yeah, they're really there to the smaller robots are to move these custom shelves that I just described a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. and the larger robots are there to move pallets.
Okay, nice.
So the way that they pick things, they're two-wheel robots. Mm-hmm. The way that they pick things up, it's a little bit difficult to explain, but and of course, if you see a video, it clearly explains itself. But imagine a screw on top of the robots with a motor on it, and we have the capability of rotating the screw independently of what the robot is doing. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that if the robot is spinning in place and the screw is spinning at exactly the opposite rate, that in inertial space, the cross that's sitting on top of the screw doesn't move. It just moves up and down. Mm-hmm. And yeah. That's how we pick things up. The robot spins underneath a pod. The screw is spun the other way such that in inertial space, it looks like it's standing still, just moving up and down. And it picks up a pod, and that is how we rotate the robot underneath the pod and move it around.
Okay. Maybe for some more techie listeners out there, can you give any technical details? Are you at liberty to say what kind of sensors you have on board? Or
yeah, I can say at a high level, I can talk about it. Mm-hmm. And before I do so, let me just kind of tell you the philosophy of our system, and I think it's a very common one in people that design control systems, mm-hmm. is that if you build accurate energy sourcing devices like actuators, it's expensive. But if you have inexpensive sensors, those can be accurate and they can also be made cheap. So our philosophy in building our vehicles is to have really good sensors, which are inexpensive, and to have sophisticated algorithms that can use that information to make it behave like it's a very precise component. So what kind of sensors do we have on there? We have things like cameras. We have inertial sensors. We also have infrared sensors.
Okay. So what about autonomy then? I guess you use electric motors and batteries on your robots?
That is correct. The robots, the drive units, only use electric motors. We don't have pneumatic or anything like that. That can be very messy. We use batteries. The robots charge themselves, so the batteries don't come out of the robots except for maintenance. And, you know, once every roughly 2 years to replace the batteries, the robots go and charge themselves. When they sense that there's a that their charge level is getting low, they coordinate themselves with the various agents that are responsible for keeping the charge of the system at a high level, and then they're slotted into a charging mission, and they go charge themselves, and when they're done, they're available for work again.
Okay. So I guess it's a bit of a scalable system. You can maybe have a warehouse where you have 500 robots and you only use 400 at a time or something like that.
Exactly.
So how do you plan exactly in terms of scalability? How many robots you need? How many should be working at once?
So that's a good question. There's various tools that we have in place, all at different levels of fidelity. So at the highest level, meaning the lowest level of fidelity, but kind of back on the envelope sort of equations, we have Excel spreadsheets that tell us roughly for a given customer demand, given customer profile, roughly how many robots will they need, roughly how many stations, roughly how many chargers, and those numbers are going to be accurate to, say, plus or minus 10%. Then what we do is we have a more detailed simulation, which really mimics the warehouse that we will be deploying. So it's a simulation that has all the details, exactly where the pods are, exactly where the vehicles are, the exact movement of the robots, et cetera. And then we can use those preliminary numbers to try out a layout for the warehouse and actually observe what the performance of that will be, and then we can refine it. And we can add robots, take robots away, move the location of the stations, et cetera. And then once we have a design that we're happy with, we talk to the customer, we present our results and say, hey, this is what we can achieve with our system. This is exactly how many robots you will need, and we go on from there.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but your first major deployment was for Staples, the American Office Supply Chain.
Yeah, in 2006, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that experience. How many robots did you use? Since it's your first deployment, did you have any big problems that you had to refine for deployments you had after that?
So, I mean, it's always a learning experience when you're deploying systems, especially when it's your first product. One of the nice things about our system is that it scales. So Staples was interested in building a large warehouse. But of course, you know, being the first customer, they're not going to say, okay, well, let's deliver a 500 robot system. Let's see how it works. So we actually started with a small system of 30 robots.
Okay.
And they were happy with the performance. Then we moved to a system with 150 robots. They were happy with the performance. And then eventually we went to a system with 500 robots.
Okay.
The things that you discover along the way are it's always the things that obviously you can't anticipate. You know, you try to take everything into account, but of course there's always issues. You know, we had problems with wireless communication, the way that you know, the access points were laid out, and one of the things that we learned is that we really like to deploy our own wireless system. And some of the our customers at first say, well, we already have a wireless system in place, can we not use it? And it's definitely something that you want to have under your control.
Yeah.
Yeah, just little things like that. There was really nothing nothing major. Some power outages led to some interesting startup behavior. In other words, after the system was down for 3 or 4 hours, we figured out that there are probably easier ways to bring our system back to life. And again, you can make the analogy of a complex system, such as a living being. You know, if you turn them off, you can't just turn them back on.
Yeah, of course.
You have to design it properly such that it is a simple procedure just to have everything boot up in the right sequence.
So speaking of interesting crashes then, I'm sure you've got a few good stories, maybe during prototyping or development or something, where robots went haywire or crazy or something.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the kind of stuff that goes on in the lab when you're trying things out. I mean, the way the product is right now, one of the most important philosophies in our system is to have checks upon checks upon checks. So obviously, you know, at the lowest level, all the hardware has watchdogs. Mm-hmm. Then the higher level processes also have watchdogs. All the high level software has watchdogs, et cetera, et cetera. So any time that something is not working the way that it should be working, we prevent the system from damaging itself. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you're prototyping these things, you know, that's only a luxury you have after the low level stuff has been designed and working, and you can test it. What are some of the funny things that that happen? Let me try to remember some of them. Well, I guess some of them are the cameras being installed in the wrong way when we were first prototyping them.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we're getting ready to have the vehicle move, and it starts moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's a bit strange.
Even more importantly, once you figure that out, and then you figure out that the coordinate systems that you're using are wrong, a right-handed system instead of a left-handed system, mm-hmm. or vice versa, the way the camera's mounted, these things are driving around and then they go unstable.
Yeah.
But these are all kind of basic, really simple things to figure out. Oh, yeah, of course we did that incorrectly. But mm-hmm. Once you figure them out, you know, it's a very robust system.
Okay. Maybe what's the biggest deployment you guys have had? Number of robots, say.
Our biggest deployment is our staple system, which is about 505 robots. Mm-hmm. We are working on a 2,000 robot system right now with a customer.
Okay, what's the biggest you can go, do you think, or is it pretty much unlimited?
It's always hard to say unlimited because you don't know what could happen. But we have simulated systems that are as large as 10,000 robots. Mm-hmm. And the simulations are pretty high fidelity ones, and they really do take things into account, all the things that we could think of. So we really see no reason why you couldn't have that. Now, I think the limitation of that is a 10,000 robot system is a huge warehouse.
Yeah.
So we've been able to target applications where maybe you would have 2,500 robots. Mm-hmm. So 10,000 would be bigger than by a factor of four of any warehouse that's out there.
Yeah. I guess there's other practical aspects at that point.
Right. In fact, there's actually an interesting point that goes with scalability, and that is, as I mentioned to you, the robots, the things are stored in the middle of the warehouse, and people work at the perimeter of the warehouse. Mm-hmm. So, how do things scale? If you just think of the dimension of the assume for now that it's square, that the warehouse is square in size. Mm-hmm. As you increase the dimension of the warehouse, the amount of stuff that you can store goes up as the quadratic of it, whereas the perimeter is linear. Mm-hmm. So actually, there are some scaling issues that you have to worry about when you get into big warehouses, is that you essentially run out of perimeter.
Yeah.
So then you have to get into doing things like not just have stations at the perimeter, but have them actually go into the warehouse and back out.
Okay. Maybe as a last question about the Kivas, tell us about what you guys are looking at in the future. How would you improve your system, or are there other parts that you would like to automate, such as the packing part of the job with some robotic arms or something?
Yeah, in fact, we're exploring those sorts of things. I think from a purely technical perspective, you know, this is our core competency, and as the technology matures in other areas, then we'll make sure that our system is able to coexist with those other technologies. Like, for example, as you said, robot arms, things that can do manipulation. Our system doesn't rely on that to exist, but we certainly want to be able to leverage off of that when it does become technologically viable. Mm-hmm. Our big emphasis right now is on making the system easier and easier to use, and to give it more capabilities at the at a high level. So we're really concentrating on algorithms more than anything else right now. It's, you know, we basically have the equivalent of a Lego system with a few components. We have robots, we have stations, and we have pods. Mm-hmm. And the system is completely configurable. So we haven't even come close to achieving all the possible things that can be done with these simple modules. And that's really where our short to medium term emphasis is on how do you efficiently use these resources.
Okay. So other than working at Kiva, Raf, you're actually a professor at ETHZ in Zurich. Let's talk about that a little bit. I guess you were working in the robotics field in the United States for many years now, and now you're working in Switzerland or in Europe. What are some of your first impressions about robotics and, yeah, about robotics in general?
Sure. Well, one thing that I should probably preface is that I don't really think of myself as a robotics person.
Okay.
I really think of myself as a systems person. My training, my PhD training, is actually in dynamics and control systems. Mm-hmm. And of course, robotics is a perfect example of a complex system. And that's kind of my take on it. I don't consider myself to be an expert in robotics in the sense of, you know, knowing everything that's out there. Although I do think of myself as an expert in systems. Mm-hmm. So I guess related to your question, what do I find?
Maybe what do you find different in systems then in Zurich and in Europe, as opposed to?
Well,
I've
only been here for a year, but as you know, the research community is pretty international. So mm-hmm. from that perspective, you know, there isn't really much of a difference whether you're in the United States or in Switzerland. You know, you go to conferences, you see colleagues from all over the world, you exchange ideas. I mean, that hasn't changed. I think what does change are the things that change are the operational issues. Like, for example, one of the reasons that I came to ETH Zurich is that I have a lot of flexibility here of how to run my research group.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I can explore different research areas than I could, for example, if I was in the United States. I could do more high risk sort of research here, I think, just because the resources given to me are not tied to any specific project.
So let's talk a little bit about robots and art, since we're talking about strange systems here.
Sure.
We recently had an interview with Professor Robert Wood at Harvard University. He had his robotic fly displayed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. You've also had some works of art or robotic art displayed, like a robotic chair in a museum in Canada. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. It's an everyday-looking chair. Mm-hmm. It looks like an old school chair, you know, with a wooden chair with four legs, a base, and a back. Mm-hmm. And the chair falls apart in a heap. The pieces move around. When, in fact, the base moves around, finds all its pieces, reattaches them, and then proceeds to reassemble itself. I don't really think of this as a robot. I think of it as a system, mm-hmm. The various algorithms, the various sensors, etc. The idea was actually from Max Dean, who's a Canadian artist. He's been wanting to do this since 1984. Since he was an artist in residence in Ottawa. And we started working on this along with Matt Donovan about 2-3 years ago. What struck me about it was that I thought I had this visual of what it would look like when it was actually completed. And I thought it was a very powerful experience, you know, to see something, an everyday object like a chair, just fall apart and then reassemble itself. That is really what motivated me, was just the vision of seeing it do that. And you know, whether you want to call it art, whether you want to call it a robot, that's almost kind of secondary to me.
Okay, so tell us maybe about this course that you're putting together at ETHZ called "And Yet It Moves."
Right. So I think my various experiences. I ran a project at Cornell called RoboCup, where we designed teams of robots to play against other teams of robots in an international robotics competition. And we were pretty successful at that. I think we won 4 times, came second once, and came third once.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that I learned doing that project, and a lot of the students that were educated in that project, have, that know-how was taken to Kiva Systems. A lot of the students are actually work at Kiva. A lot of things that I learned doing this, my knowledge was transferred to Kiva. So firsthand, I got to experience what something that may seem like it has no purpose, like building robots that play soccer, can have an industrial impact, such as Kiva systems. At the same time, I started working with these artists, and I really got a chance to see how technology could be used for something else besides, purely utilitarian objectives. And basically, all these experiences led me to form this class at ETH called And Yet It Moves, where I assemble a team of students from different disciplines, mechanical, electrical, computer science. Mm-hmm. I also have several artists that are part of the staff here that work with me in the course. And the objective is to create something that has never been built before, to employ advanced concepts from dynamics, control systems, adaptation, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and to build something that can be put on public exhibits, mm-hmm. exhibitions, installations, etc. The objectives of doing this are threefold. I think of them as it achieves three objectives. And the first one is simply just to promote research in the area. These are complex things to control, and so that naturally leads to advancement in the area. The second one is an educational one. Putting students through this experience, they learn a lot. They learn how to work in multidisciplinary teams. The PhD students that end up doing research on these platforms, they learn to work with these students, and they also learn a little bit about mechanical, electrical, computer science sort of issues. And the third objective, I think, is that it shows that we can have a different relationship with technology than we have right now. We view technology as simply a means to make things faster, cheaper, not to be too cynical, but to kind of feed this consumerism. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be that way. So that's the third thing that we're trying to promote with this class and this research agenda.
Well, it sounds very interesting. I wish I could take the course myself.
Well, you're at EPFL, right?
That's right.
So you could take it.
So maybe as a last, maybe more personal question, where do you see yourself in 10 years? What do you think you'll be working on? More ETHZ, more Kiva, or?
Oh, geez, 10 years is like a lifetime.
Five then. Let's go
yeah,
five.
Yeah, five is a better. my five-year objective is to get this program off the ground. I'd love to be able to, if I look 5 years, where do I want to be able to look back upon 5 years? I'd love to see the things that we've created at exhibitions, mm-hmm. in art galleries like we've done in the past, for people to realize that technology can be used for something else besides just purely utilitarian objectives. It'd be great to see spin-off companies to be produced by the things that we create. Why not? I mean, I'm not against it. Obviously, I've done it myself. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I'm looking at 5 years down the road, to see a whole bunch of people that have been educated through the programs and have gone on and done great things.
Excellent. Well, Raf, thank you very much for the interview. I'll call you back in 5 years to make sure all of this has been done.
Okay.
And it was great having you on the show.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you, Adam.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Excellent interview. Now let's relax a bit and be inspired by the follow-up of Jack Graham's science fiction story, The Selkies. For those who missed the debut in the last episode of Robots, Mangan, with his sea lion Kato, were striving to clean the oceans with the help of specialized sea-like robots called Selkies.
A little before dawn, Mangan opened a beer and put on his specs to browse the news, while Kato lolled happily in a wading pool full of purified seawater. He had been out here testing his bots a month now, and it would be another month before the field test of the 3 series was complete. He could have brought someone with, but Kato was better company, despite the difficulty of housebreaking a sea lion. Humans in isolation get bored, and boredom breeds quarrels. The headlines were a bit grim today, which, Mangan reflected, was his fault for filtering out celebrity news. There was drought on the North China Plain, while back home officials in Cork were pointing fingers over coastal flooding. The Indian PM was in a scandal over her alleged involvement with returning cosmonaut Tushar Soman, the first Indian on Mars. The public was streaming the former actress's old Bollywood interactives like mad, but it was bad press for the Indian Space Agency. The Americans and Russians had simultaneously announced completion of major orbital military projects, intensifying the new arms race. Worst of all, Mangan's side had lost the WFA Cup, not to favorites Bayern Munich, but to New England. At this, he pushed his specs onto his forehead. Strange times, Cato. He tossed Cato a fish, which was deftly caught and swallowed. In the distance, the Selkies were hauling onto their islets. Inside each bot, an ultrasound chamber had been breaking down PCBs throughout the night. Now, the plastic they collected was being added to the islet with a synthesized adhesive. Here the Selkie's behavior ceased to resemble harbor seals and became like that of mound-building termites. Each circled the islet, adding to the edges, then hauled up and added more plastic to the upper surface, maintaining the islet's rock-like texture. When the islet was large enough, the Selkies would begin another, and the current islet could be hauled to land. Mangan's programming modeled the principle of stigmergy. No Selkie knew what an islet should look like, but each acted in response to the shape created by what previous robots had added. Mangan did a head count on the Selkies and came up short. He pushed his specs back down and brought up a positional map of the Selkies. One was off the map and moving farther away. He ran the diagnostics, but the data coming back made no sense. He was interrupted by a bark from Cato, followed by a territorial growl. "Quiet you," he said. "I'm trying to think." But Cato continued to bark. He was at the back of the boat, watching something. In the distance, Mangan could make out another boat, and closer to him, someone in a kayak. As the stranger came into network range, he got a message. "I'm your neighbor. Permission to come aboard?" "Granted," he messaged back. He watched as the woman tied in and climbed the starboard ladder. She was a bit older than him, Latina, probably American. Mangan would never have trusted a kayak out here, but she looked ready to paddle all the way back to California. He fished a bottle out of the cooler. Cato growled a little but settled back into his tub at a warning look from Mangan. "Cerveza? It's cold, Yank style." She looked at him gravely. "So, are you the jackass responsible for the robot seals?"
Uh-oh, looks like the robotic seals are getting in trouble already. That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Our next show will air in 2 weeks, but in the meantime, stay in touch through our forum for the latest news and hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Automate Your Warehouse with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.